Hi, everyone. Welcome back to The Analysis. On this episode, you'll hear from UMD Assistant Professor Rachel Romeo and rising senior Abria Simmons. They're conducting research to figure out how early experiences influence kids' learning and brain development with a focus on kids as young as 3 years old. And to do so, they're using technology known as the functional near-infrared spectroscopy. But to get a diverse group of volunteers, they've had to get creative. Take a listen.
So who wants to start first, Rachel or Abria? First of all, how's it going with your research? And what stage are you at in your research right now?
Sure. I can give just a brief sort of like background and how we got to where we are. So I'm an assistant professor at the University of Maryland in the College of Education. Abria is a rising senior working in our lab, an invaluable contributor. Our lab group studies how children's early experiences relate to their brain development and their academic development. And so we're trying to understand both positive factors as well as some adverse factors. And so one of our key goals is to try and include children from as many different diverse backgrounds as possible so we can look at a variety of different early experiences and their early relationships. And when we first started working with this, we use this neuroimaging technology. It's a long name, functional near infrared spectroscopy, or FNIRS for short. Basically, it just uses little beams of light to track blood flow in the brain, and that gives us an idea of which regions are most active when you're doing something. So, for example, we're very interested in language development, and so we want to see that the language areas of a child's brain are really active when they're listening to stories or talking or anything like that. We quickly realized when we started using this technology, it's a relatively new one to me, it's reasonably new in the field, that it wasn't very inclusive in who could be, who we could get really good signal from. So for the technology to work really well, we have to get the light sensors all the way to the scalp. And so that any sort of differences in hair texture, thickness, density, can affect how close you can get the sensor to the scalp. And then because it's light-based, it's also somewhat sensitive to variations in hair color. The darker someone's hair is, the more we need to make sure that we're getting closer and closer to the scalp. And so you can see how this adds up, children and even adults who have afro-textured hair are at a bit of a disadvantage in terms of getting that really strong brain signal. So when I first realized that this was going to be a problem, I realized it was not a problem I could solve. Your listeners can't see me, but I'm as white as they come. And I have no idea how to solve this problem. So I reached out to try and find, someone in our environment who could help us. And that's when I found Abria, who said, "I don't know what you're doing, but it sounds fun. I can help, I think." And then basically we've done a lot of trial and error since then. Abria, do you want to take over and talk about some of the different things we've done or that you've led?
Yeah. So like Rachel said, it's been a lot of trial and error. We began with adult pilots before we have done any of our kids that we have actually run through our study. I believe at this point we've had about 4 kids who have needed the intervention in our study. But like I said, we began with pilots of adults. A lot of them were my friends and my family who were able to take the time out of their schedules to come and help me with my project. And we began with just techniques that I know as a Black person. I have been braiding my own hair since I was about 13. So I know some of the core styles like flat twists and cornrows. And so I figured that was where I would begin my investigation. And I kind of went from there. We tried cornrows and that didn't quite work. I even tried box braids, which I thought would be the best because parting is so precise when you get box braids, and that didn't work. So ultimately, we have kind of come to some interventions where we have found that if you do part the hair precisely to where the sensors and detectors are on a cap, you can get some great signal optimization, but we're still, you know, trying to figure out what is best, and we want to come up with a myriad of different options for all the different types of hair textures and hair types and hairstyles that come into our lab.
Very cool. So what is your background, your major, Bria? What were you interested in at first when you went to UMD?
Yeah, so I'm a psych major, and I declared my human development minor, I believe, winter semester of my sophomore year of college. And I knew that I wanted to do research of some kind. At this point, I had determined that I wanted to go and get my PhD in counseling psychology. So I knew research would be a very large part of that process. And I knew that I just wanted to get in touch with some research. But because there's so many psychology labs on our campus, they're very competitive. And at the time, they weren't seeking undergraduates. And I was actually taking Rachel's class. She teaches Paradigms and Perspectives of Human Development, which is basically Intro to Human Development. And I was taking her class, and she had just put out during class that she was hiring undergrads and that she needed someone who had some expertise in working with African Americans and had some expertise in braiding Afro-textured hair. And I went up to her after class and I was like, hey, I don't have any like formal training. I know, you know, what works on my hair. And I was taught by my mom how to do my hair. But like I said, I don't have any formal training. I'm interested in your position. She gave me the form to fill out the application. I think I had an interview with Rachel and our lab manager, Ellie, maybe a week after. And then a couple weeks after that, I found out I got into the lab.
Awesome. And so you started this your sophomore year?
Yes.
And what's your classification now?
I'm a rising senior.
Rising senior. So what have you all found from using the technology for about 2 years now? And what are some of your takeaways?
Sorry. I can just start, and then I ultimately want to let Abria answer, since it's really the project is really hers. We've been through a lot of trial and error, a lot of learning. And I think we were hoping there would be a resounding conclusion, right? This is the hairstyle that best fits this research study or this method. And unfortunately, it's never that easy. It seems we're coming to find is that every person is different, right? As you would expect, everyone's hair is a little bit different. Everyone's tolerance is a little bit different, especially when we're working with little children. You know, we don't have hours to spare. Their attention spans are short. Working with children down to age 3. And so ultimately what Abria has really come up with is sort of this menu of options. So for depending on someone's hair length, hair texture, you know, willingness to sit still for a little bit of time, we have several different options. So she's put together this really beautiful sort of intake survey that asks people about their normal hair care practices, asks if children are tender headed or if there are certain products that they use or that parents would be comfortable with us using, things like certain gels or heat or anything like that. And then we sort of go from there. When the person comes into the lab, we, you know, have sort of an order of operations. Okay, maybe we'll try this, maybe we'll try this based on their hair. And ultimately, it goes a little bit differently for everyone. Sorry, I spoke longer than I said I would. Avria, do you want to add to that?
Like Rachel said, sometimes in the moment, we are actively changing our process. The way that it works is that when participants fill out a survey and they mark that their race or ethnicity is Black or African American, they get sent that additional intake survey. And then once they complete that survey, my lab manager connects me with the parent, and then I can talk to them through email about what, you know, they may expect when they come in for their, you know, their session. Our last session I actually had, we were able to get on a Zoom meeting and, you know, sort of hatch what was the best approach for this specific participant that came into our lab. And then from there, like I said, through our different processes, I'm normally there for one of the previous sessions for the kid. So we have a MRI, a behavioral task, and then the FNIRS task that the kid goes through. And so normally we're trying to have me be at either the behavioral or MRI so the kid can get familiar with me, knows who they'll be interacting with. And then when they come in for their FNIRS visit, they're not like, hey, this is some random person I've never seen before. And then like Rachel said, we kind of, you know, go from there. We, you know, make decisions in the moment about, you know, what is best for the kid, because like Rachel said, we work with kids as young as three, and you know, at some points they're just like, hey, I'm good. And obviously we stop, you know, what we're doing. Our last kid was actually pretty resilient and she sat for quite a bit of time for us. But honestly, it's trial and error. And, you know, if we get signal, we get signal. You know, if not, we know what we need to change for the next time.
Very cool. In layman's terms, how would you describe to a stranger what you have been doing for the last 2 years?
Well, that's a great question. I would say this is probably most understandable for individuals with darker skin who have experienced this in the world. But I don't know. I've heard stories of folks coming to me and saying, yeah, sometimes I go to the automatic soap dispenser and it won't dispense. Or you know, the pulse oximeter at the doctor's office or the hospital doesn't track well for me. We heard a lot about that during COVID. And those are similar examples of a light-based technology not working for Black skin or Black hair. And we're encountering several similar difficulties in our research. This technology it's an incredible technology. It's incredibly powerful, and it's great when it works, but it's not super well designed for Black hair and Black skin. It's designed for, you know, ideally short, thin hair for on a Caucasian or white person. And so it's taken some trial and error to really design. Well, let me restate that last bit. We're not engineers. We're not going to go in and change the technology itself. That's not where our expertise lies. There are people working on that. And in fact, we are starting to consult with some of the engineers who make the technology themselves and tell them what we think works and doesn't work. But since we can't change the technology itself, what we can do is work with the participants and try and make the technology fit them a little bit better. And so it involves a lot of creative hairstyling, probably yeah. Not hairstyles that you would want to wear out. I don't think these are going to be making it fashionable anytime soon.
You never know. So it sounds to me like this technology that's on the market is comparable to technology that's also on the market. And there is no innovative way at this point to accomplish what you guys are trying to accomplish, which is trying to reach the scalp, essentially, to do the research that you need to do. Walk us through that. The technology as it stands right now, if you go to a doctor's office or any other neuro researcher or doctor that specializes in neuroscience, at this point, there's no way for them to accomplish what you guys are trying to accomplish, which is trying to reach the scalp to see what's going on in the brain.
Well, I think if you were going to a medical office, they would have a few more bags of tricks. And if you're going to a medical office, you're probably willing to undergo a few more interventions, I should say. So they can use a specific type of gel in your hair. They can do other types of interventions that are a little more what I would call invasive or, you know, disruptive to your day-to-day life. But because we are a research lab, everything we're doing is voluntary and optional. Our number one goal is to make the participants as comfortable as possible. We ideally want you to leave not feeling like you've had your hair pulled and tugged and in terribly different ways. And so it's a bit of a finer balance between finding what works for the technology and what is comfortable and palatable for the participants. So I don't want to say that this doesn't exist. It certainly does in more medical contexts. But because this is, you know, purely optional research focused on sort of, you know, academic trajectories, nothing catastrophic, you know, we're not looking at, you know, any sort of like brain injury or anything like that. We want to avoid some of the more severe interventions. We have no intention of shaving anyone's head or no. Anything like that.
Yeah, from what it sounds like, there's no convenient way at this point to accommodate people with different hair types beyond just doing something that they're not comfortable or accustomed to. My cousin is a nurse practitioner who specializes in neuroscience. I texted her about this and let her know what you guys were doing, that she thought it was cool. She said, I love that. I see the limitations so many times because of this. I order things and they can't get done because of a weave. So, yeah, it can be tough depending on what you have going on. And, you know, in the Black community, we have many different hairstyles. I can attest to that. I've changed my hair 100 different times. Even this weekend, I had a fro. Right now, it's straight. But the point here is you guys are trying to meet people where they are because you are trying to do this research in a way that is a little bit more comfortable for them, which is something that we would hope that we would see in the real world as well, where people can be hopefully as sensitive. So that's great. So in layman's terms as well, what are you trying to find out with your research? And what is the problem you're trying to fix?
Yeah, so our broader research is really trying to understand how early adversity affects early brain development, and then various different protective factors that can support resilience. So things like really strong relationships between parents and children, between teachers and children, to try and understand how that really supports brain development, no matter the circumstances that you're in. So ultimately, certainly adversity is associated with race and ethnicity in our country. But our goal is not necessarily to investigate race or ethnicity specifically. It's really to try and understand these more relationship-based factors. But to do that, you have to have methods that work the same way for everyone. So if we're getting different measures on a Black child and a white child, then we can't answer the questions that we set out to, because our methods aren't working the same way. And so the problem that we really need to overcome is to make sure that our brain science methods, amongst other methods too, not just the neuroimaging methods, but all the methods that we're using are appropriate and actually tapping into what we want it to tap into. I don't know, Bree, if you want to add anything to that.
I guess that's also a reason why we want our sample to be representative, because if it's not, then, you know, we can't necessarily generalize our findings to the whole population, because, I mean, America and the broader, you know, world is so diverse. If you are only getting, you know, statistics and, you know, data from a small subset of, you know, people who are not necessarily the whole, you know, percentage of the population, then, you know, something could be happening in Black families that could be, you know, a resilience factor that we can't find because our technology isn't, you know, made with them in mind, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's such a good point. A lot of research, if you can't get the measures, you just exclude the participant, right? So just like you said, they can't order the tests on certain people medically, in research, we just kick them out and say, you know, thank you for your time, but we're unable to include you in our data set, in our analyses. And that can lead to really biased results. If we end up, you know, only being able to study white children and then saying, look, this is how resilience works in the brain, but it's actually just for some people.
Rachel, what made you want to push harder to include a more diverse data set?
It's ethically right. I'm both as a scientist, as a scientist, I want to understand how processes work for all children, right? It's certainly interesting to understand how it works in some children and not others, but I selfishly want to understand it all. and I was disappointed to see how certain methods just exclude people. It's certainly been a more time intensive process to try and invent methods. That was never really our intention. I don't consider ourselves like methodologists necessarily, but when what you want doesn't exist, you kind of have to create it.
That is true. And so what's next for you ladies? It's been about 2 years of research. Any early findings?
Great questions. We're still in the process. So this is a longitudinal study that we're working on right now. So we're tracking children throughout their preschool years from 3 to 5, and they'll come back to the lab and do some of the same assessments again. And we'll look at the growth over time and try and understand how different experiences relate to that. So we're still trucking on that front. However, in terms of Bria's more methodological research, we do have plans to get that out a little bit earlier. Bria, I don't know if you want to say anything.
Yeah, so like Rachel said earlier, we've been in talks with the company that makes our technology. The company is called Nurex, and we do have a planned webinar in October to, you know, speak to researchers who are interested in, you know, making their samples as diverse as our samples are, and are interested in, you know, fixing these problems. I also will be working this summer to write a paper for this project. It's gonna be an interesting journey. And I'm actually a McNair scholar. So a part of me being a McNair scholar is to generate new knowledge and work on my own research project for this first half of the summer. So we'll be writing that paper for most of the summer. But honestly, I hope that, you know, more people are interested in the topic and continue on this research after I graduate, because fortunately I only have one more year of my undergrad. So we'll see what happens when I graduate.
Nice. So how much longer until we find out what happened with the research, what, you know, the findings are?
So in terms of more the methodological pieces, that we should have results by the end of the summer. And that way we can start to distribute those. So Abria is working on a research paper, but then also this more informational session for other researchers. We get emails all the time from other researchers saying, how do I do it? How do I fix it? So we know there are other people interested in this as well. And, you know, we want to make sure that everyone has access to these strategies. In terms of, you know, the bigger picture research, it'll probably be at least another year before we have much to report. We're bringing kids in as quickly as we can, but it's always a little tricky. So if anyone out there wants to participate, we're still recruiting 3 and 4 year olds in the DMV area. And then hopefully in about a year we'll have more to say.
Okay, great. I mean, it seems like a fascinating topic. This is just an example, but what are some of the things that you are hoping to pinpoint for people in the summary of what the research found? Obviously, this is not the exact findings, but examples.
Sure. Yeah. So prior versions of this study, not exactly the same, but similar with children of different ages and from different backgrounds. We focused a lot on socioeconomic adversity. So when children and families have low income or are unable to meet some of their needs, we find that typically, on average, that leads to worse cognitive outcomes. You know, children from lower socioeconomic backgrounds tend to struggle more with academic learning, with learning different cognitive and socio-emotional skills. However, we've also really found really robust findings that a lot of those effects can be mitigated when children have a really strong relationship with a caregiver. So whether it be a parent, a grandparent, or some other role model in their life, when there are really strong relationships with that person, it can reduce the negative effects of a low SES early environment. That's something we've found in the past for slightly older children, and we expect to find it similarly for children in this age. We're hoping to dig a little bit more into those relationships and try and understand, what is it about those relationships? You know, is it certain forms of communication? Is it certain forms of emotion that is shared? That way we can try and understand these resilience factors a little bit more.
Oh, wonderful. And so why is this research so important for people who may not understand that?
Well, I think it's really important for a couple of reasons. One, I think we talk a lot, we hear a lot from various different sources that children from lower income backgrounds are doing worse, right? We hear about these academic achievement gaps. We hear about, lower rates of all sorts of things. And while that's true on average, it's just an average. Individual children have vastly different individual circumstances. And the majority of children experiencing some form of adversity are actually doing well, and some even better than would be expected, better than average. And so I think it's really important to try and push back against that, what we call a deficit narrative, and actually try and understand different aspects of children's resilience and families' resilience, and really understand how families are really supporting their children's development no matter their circumstances.
Oh, that's wonderful. And so how does the technology help? How does that specific technology help with what you're researching?
Yeah, so it helps us look a little bit, look under the hood and see what's going on in children's brains. So we can do a number of different assessments that don't require brain imaging. We can test a child's vocabulary or how many words they know. We can test how good their executive functioning skills are and how they can self-regulate their emotions. And we can ask parents to fill out surveys, how does your child do on all of these different factors? And that's all really valuable information, but it's still somewhat subjective, right? It's filtered through the view of the caregiver or filtered through the view of a researcher or whoever created the test, which we know tests aren't always super valid. Not to say neuroscience is perfect, but it gives us a bit more of an unbiased view about how someone's brain is actually processing information in real time. And so we can look at the brain activity while a child is processing speech, or look at their brain activity while they're trying to regulate their emotions during a frustration task or something like that. And that gives us a little bit more of an objective view of what's going on. And then we can look at sort of the mechanistic ways that the brain supports these different outcomes that we see on the day to day. So that's one of the reasons we really want the technology to work well.
Great. And how long has this technology been available to the public? And would you say that this is something that is going to stay with us for a while?
It's been around for about a decade or more. It's been around for a while. I'd say the arc of research uptake of new methods is slow generally. I'd say within the last 4 or 5 years, I've really started to see this technology boom, and see it take over some other different neuroimaging measures that have been common for years and years. And then it still happened. People still use. I definitely don't think it's going away because it's got some incredible advantages. So one of the techniques that spent a lot of my time using before is MRI. Anyone who's ever had or seen an MRI knows you have to go inside a tube, you have to lay perfectly still, it's incredibly loud, and that's not super fun for young children. Well, it's not fun for adults either. We try and make it fun for children, but it's not naturalistic, I'll put it that way. Whereas this FNIRS technology, it's mobile. We can pack it in a suitcase and take it off to different, we've actually taken it into schools and community centers and clinics. It's reasonably tolerant of motion too. So in that MRI, you have to lay perfectly still. So we can get a clear picture of the brain, with FNIRS. It's not great if you're literally bouncing off the walls, but, it can tolerate a decent amount of motion. So it's good for young children. One thing we're really excited about is that it's really great for, you can actually measure two or more people's brains at the same time and look at how their brains are interacting with each other in real time. And so I think we're going to see more and more of this technology. And that's another reason it's so important to make sure that, it's being used in representative samples with unbiased measurements.
Great. Really looking forward to your research, you all. Thank you so much, Abria. It sounds like you really hit the jackpot with your research project, so congrats. Any final thoughts on anything relating to the research, the outcome, maybe where you're sharing it? Well, you're sharing it publicly, where you're hoping it will end up benefiting people the most.
I would just add really briefly, we get asked a lot of times from other researchers, what is What is the magic component? How do you make it work? And a lot of times the first thing we ask is your team, your research team, diverse? Do you have a Black individual on your research team? And a lot of times the answer is no. We think that although an adjacent problem is related as well, that when the research teams are not representative, then you don't know what you're missing. You don't know what questions aren't being asked quite right, and what measures aren't quite right. That's something we talk a lot about, making sure that, of course, we want representative samples of participants, but it's really important to have representative research teams as well. Abria, would you like to add to that? I know that's something you talk about a lot as well.
Yeah. Rachel hit the nail on the head. I am very lucky to be in a lab that, you know, is all femme presenting or female. Unfortunately, that's, you know, even a barrier in the research field, but also our, you know, team is pretty diverse. And, you know, if you're going to work with diverse samples, you know, why not have your team be diverse? And I feel like this specific problem is one that is close to my heart, because obviously I'm a Black woman. I have faced barriers with our MRI, you know, suite. I'm not allowed to get an MRI when I have braids in my hair because it could possibly be a safety issue in our MRI center. And so I know this is an issue that, you know, not only has affected, you know, researchers and grad students that are in the field, but also regular people. And, you know, Black people deserve, you know, to be represented in these spaces. They deserve to, you know, have their voices heard, and they deserve to, you know, be in studies if they want to. You know, it's voluntary. You know, they're aiding their time and, you know, sometimes even, you know, their gas mileage to come to our lab. And, you know, I really want to, you know, make sure that they're as comfortable in our lab as possible.
Thanks for listening. You can watch this story on dcnewsnow.com and check back next week for another extended conversation in Tech Talk.